the mirror. You're talented.
That's kind of you to say so. The barber looked pleased. He used a sponge to wipe away the strands of hair from Reseng's head and the front of the cape and from his own arms. Then he lathered up the back of Reseng's neck and shaved off the stray hairs. All done. The barber carefully removed the cape and guided Reseng over to the sink. He placed a showerhead in a plastic basin and filled it with hot water. When it was half full, he mixed in several scoops of cold water from a barrel and checked the temperature. He added some more cold water and felt it again, repeating the process several times. When the temperature seemed just right, he handed Reseng a plastic dipper instead of the showerhead. Sometimes the water turns scalding and startles customers. I know it's a little awkward, but you'll be better off using this. Reseng nodded and used the dipper to pour water over his head. Thanks to the barber's careful work, the temperature was perfect. The tiny snippets of hair spilling into the white sink looked like ellipses on the blank page of a book. While Reseng shampooed his hair, the barber put two clean towels on the counter and hummed as he swept the floor. Reseng filled the dipper again, this time with cold water, to splash his face, and dried his hair with one of the towels. A chest of drawers next to the mirror was piled high with unopened envelopes. Reseng slipped one of the envelopes out of the pile while pretending to towel his hair. It was an urgent reminder of overdue hospital bills.
You don't see many barbershops like these nowadays. I'm guessing business is good here? Reseng asked as he dried his ears with a towel.
Hardly. Nowadays, young people prefer to get their hair cut in salons by pretty stylists. Why would they come to an old-timer like me? But since we're on the outskirts of the city and there's an army base nearby, the officers drop by now and then, and the old guys in the neighborhood come here to play chess and get a shave. So I managed to make ends meet.
He discarded the hair he'd swept up, placing it in a blue plastic trash can. Reseng sat back down while the barber brought out a hairdryer and began to dry his hair for him.
Would you like a shave today?
Reseng stroked his chin. Three freshly sharpened straight razors sat side by side on the counter, as spick and span as the barber himself.
I just shaved this morning, Reseng said.
The barber nodded and handed him a comb. Reseng combed his hair and studied himself in the mirror. The barber wasn't lying about his 30 years of experience. It was a flawless haircut.
Are you from here originally?
Reseng asked.
Yes, born and raised. Did my army training here too.
The HID base is here, right? Where they used to train secret agents to send into North Korea.
Reseng continued to arrange the front of his hair. The barber's hands skipped a beat in the middle of folding the cape.
That was a long time ago. Not that I would know anything about it. I was just an ordinary infantryman.
It must be hard living way out here.
Reseng poured some aftershave into his hands and patted it onto his face. It smelled the same as whatever the barber had used on his own skin.
It's a little boring at times, but it's not bad. Once a month, my wife and I visit a retirement home in the mountains of Gangwon province and give haircuts to old people there. It's a chance for us to enjoy the fresh country air.
Do you have any other side jobs?
You mean like driving a taxi?
No, more like assassinations and contract killings.
The barber's face hardened.
You have an odd sense of humor. How could a weak old barber do those terrible things you only see in movies?
You look pretty trim and agile to me.
Reseng looked the barber up and down.
Not an ounce of flab on you.
I wouldn't call it trim, more like scrawny.
The barber lowered his gaze to the floor.
Is that so?
That is so.
How much for the haircut?
7,001.
That's cheap.
Country prices.
Reseng walked over to the coat rack and reached into the inside pocket of his leather jacket. He felt the weight of Chu's knife. The barber tossed Reseng's used towel into the laundry bin and started washing his hands in the sink. With his back to Reseng, he said,
"Let's leave that knife where it is. Take it out and you're dead."
Reseng put the jacket on. The barber dried his hands on a fresh towel. Reseng walked over to the front door and locked it. Slowly, he pulled Chu's Henkels from its leather sheath. Chu's handkerchief was still tied around the top of the handle. The barber put the towel on a chair and shook his head at Resing.
Pretty sure I already fought that knife's owner. What's your name?
Resing.
Then you're from the library.
The barber's voice was hollow. He placed his left hand on the headrest of the chair. There was no trace of fear in his face, despite the knife in front of him.
Am I on the library's list? He asked.
There's no list. This is personal.
Personal?
The barber gazed off into space, his eyes fixed on some distant point. He might have been recalling past events. Occasionally, his eyes glazed over. A faint shadow appeared over his melancholy upturned face and then vanished. Resing gauged the distance between them, about 4 meters. One step, and then another quick step, and then a leap, and he could sink his knife into the barber's throat. An antique grandfather clock on the wall ticked loudly. The silence continued. Resing had been holding the knife up in front of his solar plexus, and it was getting heavy. He lowered it. The barber tore his eyes away from whatever spot he'd been contemplating and looked at Resing.
Is this because of the boy I killed a few days ago?
It might be, and it might not be.
Resing looked down at the Henkels. A single loose thread was sticking out of the knot in the handkerchief. Resing plucked it and let the thread drop to the floor. The barber stared hard at the knot.
To be honest, I don't really know why I'm doing this, Resing said with a smile.
Then you can still walk away.
Resing smirked.
I don't know about that. I'm already here. How can I walk away now?
It takes more courage to put a knife back in its sheath and walk away than it does to take a knife out.
I guess I'm a coward then. Sorry.
The barber lifted his hand from the chair and started to say something, then stopped himself. He let out a deep sigh. His shoulders drooping, he looked old and frail, like one of those elderly men who sit on park benches in the sun. Bits of black hair were stuck to the front of his white smock.
I feel bad about the knife's owner, and bad about the boy, but I had no choice. You and I are both assassins, so you know what I mean.
Yes, I do know what you mean.
Since I'm not on your list, and you're not on my list, we have no reason to fight. We're not the type to settle things this way. We're just assassins for hire.
Yes, we are just assassins for hire.
Are you going to put the knife down and walk away?
The barber was staring him straight in the eye.
No.
Why not?
Boredom. All kinds of boredom. Boredom that slowly eats us up, like rust, on both sides of the knife. Since we're both assassins, I think you know what I mean.
Resing mimicked the barber's voice. The barber's face fell. He looked at the 3 freshly sharpened razors sitting side by side on a towel. They were not what he'd used on Trainer and Chu.
Mind waiting a second?
The barber asked. Resing nodded. The barber took off the white smock and hung it up, then went into another room farther inside the shop. Resing moved the Henkels from his right hand to his left and wiped the sweat from his palm onto his jeans. The checkerboard pattern on the floor, which would soon be slick with someone's blood, made him dizzy. The ticking of the grandfather clock paused for a moment, and a chime rang out, signaling that it was 3 p.m. The barber came back in. He opened a black bag and peered inside before pulling out a knife. It was a Mad Dog Seal ATAK, the kind Trainer had used. It had a serrated back and was the same brand that Resing had used when Trainer first taught him how to use a knife. Mercenaries from the Special Forces loved those knives. Simple design, excellent cutting power, and a superior grip, which made it easy to grab even in the dark. Sharp and strong, but also very expensive and difficult to find nowadays.
Nice knife, Resing said.
Better than yours.
The barber was watching Resing in the mirror. He looked forlorn. He glanced back and forth between Resing's reflection and his own, and let out a short sigh. then closed the bag. He walked to the center of the barber shop and stood in front of Retting.
"Good timing," he said, gesturing at the grandfather clock with his chin. "My wife's not home. She still thinks I'm an ordinary barber."
"Good for her, for never figuring it out."
"Is that a good thing?"
"Not knowing is better than pretending not to know, especially when it comes to people like us."
"I suppose you're right," he said, lowering his head as he echoed Retting. "It's much better not to know people like us."
The barber raised his head and locked eyes with Retting. It seemed there was nothing left for them to say. Retting switched to a reverse grip and dropped into a fighting stance. The barber didn't move. He just stood there, relaxed, his arms behind his back and the knife hidden. Retting gauged the distance between them again. 2 meters? If he took a step forward and swung the knife, he might be able to graze the barber's throat or chest with the tip of the blade. But the barber just stood there. There wasn't an ounce of tension in his shoulders or neck or arms. He was waiting for Retting, inviting him in, all stance and no strength. Retting realized he was making the wrong move. He straightened up and turned the knife around so the blade was pointing in front of him. Then he very slowly leaned his body forward half a step. The tip of the knife nearly reached the barber's throat, but the barber, apparently unconcerned, did not move at all. The ticking of the grandfather clock was unusually loud. The barber blinked. Retting used that moment to lunge for his throat. The barber pivoted his shoulders a fraction of an inch to dodge the blade, while the knife he'd hidden behind his back darted out and sliced Retting's forearm. Then he feinted to the left, slicing Retting in the side as he went. Before Retting could turn all the way around to face the barber, who was now behind him, the barber stabbed him in the thigh, released the knife with a twist, and stabbed him again in the left armpit. Retting swung his knife wide, but the barber skipped backwards a few steps. The distance between them opened to about 2.5 meters. The barber flicked the blood from his knife. Then he put his arms behind his back again and looked at Retting. He wasn't the slightest bit winded. Blood dripped onto the checkered linoleum. It trailed down Retting's forearm and over the back of his hand, soaking Chu's handkerchief. The blood was warm. Retting slowly looked down at himself. The blood pouring from his side and under his arm had already soaked his white shirt and was dripping from his belt. He reached inside his leather jacket to feel the wound. It wasn't as deep as he'd feared. If he hadn't been wearing the jacket, the blade might have gone much deeper. The barber was keeping his knife hidden behind his back. Now that he'd exposed Retting's weaknesses, he looked carefree, even arrogant, inviting Retting in again. But that would be the wrong move. If Retting went at him, he'd get cut again. It was hard to tell where the barber's weight was centered, and, without seeing his knife, Retting couldn't tell where the next slash would come from. The knife wouldn't move until Retting did. He couldn't read anything from the barber, not from his face, his eyes, or his feet. He wasn't even completely sure where the barber's feet were planted. It struck him then that he was not going to win. He was going to die there. Retting switched the knife to his left hand. The barber cocked his head at this. Retting took a step forward, the blade aimed at the barber's throat. The barber didn't move. Retting took another half step forward. The barber still did not move. His eyes invited him in again. Retting slid his foot forward and simultaneously lunged at the barber's throat with his left hand. The barber took the knife out from behind his back and sliced Retting's left forearm just as Retting's right hand jabbed the barber hard in the throat. The barber staggered backward. Retting switched the knife to his right hand and lunged at the barber's face. The barber threw his head back to dodge it, but his face wasn't Retting's actual target. The handkerchief sank deep into the barber's inner left thigh. Retting pulled it out and turned the blade so it was facing skyward and aimed for the barber's abdomen. The barber regained his footing and blocked the knife with the back of his hand, simultaneously sticking his own knife into Retting's side as Retting lunged toward him. The blade plunged deep into Retting's body, then withdrew. Retting fell to his knees. The barber took several steps back to catch his breath. Blood was gushing out of Reseng's side. He felt dizzy. He stuck the tip of his knife into the floor and struggled to keep from collapsing. The barber stood there looking down at the top of Reseng's head. "Using your left hand as bait," the barber said as he flicked away the blood dripping down the back of his hand. "You learn fast, much faster than the knife's owner." Drops of blood fell from the tip of his mad dog. Blood was gushing from his thigh and soaking the leg of his pants. But Reseng realized that was as far as it would go. His knife would not reach the barber's heart. Reseng leaned on his knife and staggered up to a standing position. The barber shook his head. Reseng tried to grip Chu's knife again, but he had no strength in his right hand. "The nice thing about this job is that I don't have to disinfect my knives," the barber said.
"Hilarious,"
Reseng said, with a weak laugh. "I guess I can't ask you to stop now."
"I'm nearly there."
Reseng swung the knife at him uselessly. The barber grabbed Reseng's right wrist with his left hand and twisted it, then sank the mad dog deep into Reseng's right side. Reseng slumped to his knees again. The barber knelt in front of him and pulled the knife out. Then he placed his hand on Reseng's chest. He seemed to be catching his breath, because he paused there for a moment with his head down and his eyes fixed on the floor. "I'm sorry," he said. "This old barber is so ashamed of himself." Reseng lost his balance and leaned his head on the barber's shoulder. With Reseng's head resting against him, the barber pressed the tip of his finger between Reseng's ribs, looking for the right spot to insert his knife. Then he aimed for Reseng's heart. A soft, pale hand came out of nowhere and wrapped around the blade. The sharp edge sank into the delicate skin. Blood dripped. The barber did not move or turn his head.
"Honey, you can stop now. Our daughter wouldn't want this either."
Reseng lifted his forehead from the barber's shoulder and looked up. A woman, 50-something, with a gentle-looking face, was standing behind the barber, crying silently.
"It's time for us to say goodbye to our daughter and let her go," she said. "We've lived long enough, too."
The barber's hand shook violently on the knife's grip. Reseng was dizzy. He had lost too much blood. He rested his forehead on the barber's shoulder again. Blood continued to drip from the barber's wife's lovely pale hand, which was still squeezing the blade. The sound of the barber's wife's stifled tears was as cold as the winter wind seeping in through a crack in the door. His head resting on the barber's shoulder, Reseng passed out. The door to the left. He heard laughter. Laughter like a flower garden in May. Laughter like the winds of tiny birds flying low and fast, like the buzzing of honeybees busily cruising the tops of flowers. Endless chatter followed by firecracker bursts of laughter. What was so funny? The sound made Reseng laugh along in his sleep, although he had no idea what he was laughing at. Where was he? He heard running water. Was there a stream nearby? Not likely. There were no streams. It was just the sound ringing in his ears for no reason. Ever since becoming an assassin, he had sometimes heard this sound in his dreams, and each time he thought to himself that this must be death, lying still in a place with the sound of water in the background. A place just like this one, where he could hear water, where he could not move any part of his body, where he lay stretched on a cold gravel bed, looking up at the sky for an eternity. It occurred to him, suddenly, that death must be very close. He fell back to sleep. Reseng walked slowly into a forest carpeted in fog. His feet sank deep into its plush vapor, his pace as slow and plodding as that of an ox carrying a child on its back. Leaves weighted with ice-cold dew licked his cheeks as he passed. There, under the trees, was the nunnery's garbage can, where Reseng was born. He looked inside. It was filled with baby's breath. His cradle wasn't as bad as he thought. He turned his face to the sky and laughed. The leaves of a 1,000-year-old ginkgo tree laughed with him. He threw his head back and looked up at the countless ginkgo leaves hanging from the heavy canopy. As the wind blew, the leaves all tipped in the same direction and laughed in chorus. "What's so funny?" he wondered. He cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted at the leaves. "Tell me what's so funny. Let me in on the joke." But they just kept laughing and did not answer.
"Tee-hee-hee-hee, tee-hee-hee-hee."
The tittering of the ginkgo leaves sounded like the laughter of factory girls, laughing girls brightening an alley at lunchtime. Walking along the beautiful forest path beneath a tunnel of tall trees were four factory girls, giggling as they went. A girl with a cute round face clutched her belly, as if she'd been laughing too hard, and said,
"Oh, that's too funny. That's hilarious."
Reseng was delighted to see them.
"What are you doing here so deep in the forest?" he asked, blocking their path. "Don't you have to get back to work?"
The factory girls shook their heads.
"Who are you?"
"Don't you know me? I did chrome plating on work team 3. I rode the bicycle with the pink basket."
They shook their heads again. They did not know him. They tried to walk past. He blocked the way. They cowered and looked scared. But the round-faced girl was brave.
"Get out of our way," she said.
He grinned and pointed at her.
"I know you well."
"How do you know me?"
Her eyes widened. "You have a birthmark on your left butt cheek, in the shape of a rabbit, and two birthmarks next to your right nipple. One big, one little. Like a snowman. Like the sun and the moon. And, you hate men who throw away pairs of underwear after wearing them only once. You say it's a waste of money. That's why you wash underwear hundreds of times before throwing them out. You squat on the bathroom floor and hum happy songs while scrubbing pairs of underwear until they eventually fall apart. And when you get angry, your ears turn red."
The furious factory girl's earlobes had indeed turned red.
"Ha, see, they're turning red right now," he said excitedly.
She slapped him hard across the cheek. His eyes filled with tears as he stared at her, but she was still angry. She raised her hand again. Scared, Reseng turned away.
"You really don't know me. You don't remember?" he asked between tears.
"No, I don't know you."
A look of irritation crossed her face as she said,
"What a weirdo, I swear."
The four girls continued along the beautiful forest path, leaving him behind. He could still hear their chattering voices in the distance.
"What's with that guy? Is he crazy? I don't know how you can be so brave. I thought I was going to die of fright. Seriously, he didn't look like a creep, so maybe he's just stupid."
Their non-stop chattering could be heard all the way from the end of that long forest path. Then, more bubbles of laughter. Why didn't she remember him? He stared down the path where the girls had gone. He heard water again. Ice-cold water running over gravel.
"Am I dead?"
he asked himself in his dream. The ginkgo leaves rattled in the wind as they answered him.
"You're dead. Long dead. Long, long dead."
The ancient trees nodded, as if it must be true. When Reseng came to, the first thing he saw was a skinny blonde Barbie standing on his chest. Misa was holding the doll and poking its legs into his collarbone. Pooh Bear was sitting alongside Barbie, and a stuffed Dalmatian stared dumbly at him from his solar plexus. Misa picked up the Dalmatian and shook it.
"Boring! Oh my god, I'm so bored!"
The dog wagged its tail and scampered across Reseng's stomach. Misa grabbed the Barbie again.
"Oh, he's so muscular!"
Barbie exclaimed.
"You have a thing for muscles, don't you?"
said Pantsless Pooh.
"But this is a hill we're standing on. Who ever heard of a muscular hill?" "Shut up, potbelly Pooh,"
said Barbie.
"Go put on some underwear."
Misa walked the Barbie doll down Reseng's chest and onto his stomach. Each time the doll's legs pressed into him, his knife wounds ached so much it felt like they were reopening.
"Misa, that hurts," Reseng whispered.
She jumped in surprise, then smiled brightly and called out toward the living room.
Mito, Sumin, Reseng is awake!
Mito and the cross-eyed librarian ran into the room and stared at Reseng. They looked as if they were staring down into a well. Mito held one finger up in front of his eyes and moved it slowly from left to right and right to left. He frowned and ignored her finger. Mito's eyes bored into his for a moment, and she laughed.
Hey there, Mr. Frankenstein, she said.
Reseng looked around. They were in a cabin. Outside the window was a persimmon tree that had shed its leaves, and beyond that was a high mountain.
Where are we? He asked.
The house where Mito was conceived,
Mito said, referring to herself in the third person, as if Reseng were a child.
The weekend farm where my father tricked my naive mother into coming with him to pick tomatoes so he could jump her, though fortunately that's how Mito was born. Sis!
Misa gave her an angry look.
Oh, sorry. Our darling Misa was conceived in love, with consent, but her big sister's birth wasn't so nice. Whenever our mother was angry with our father, she told me, "That man jumped me. He grabbed me from behind when I was picking tomatoes. That's where you came from. And that's why my life turned out this way." Each time she told me that, our dad's face turned bright red and he didn't know what to do with himself.
Mito burst into laughter. Misa and the librarian stared dumbly at her.
How long was I out for? Reseng asked.
Misa held up five fingers. Reseng's face fell.
Are you hungry?
Misa asked. Was he? This was his body, but he couldn't seem to feel anything.
I can't tell, he said.
You must be starving. You haven't eaten for 5 days, after all. Why would he be starving? He's been gulping up all that expensive dextrose solution,
the librarian said with a pout.
You know that's not the same as food,
said Misa.
I'll make him some delicious rice porridge.
She wheeled over to the kitchen. Reseng raised his head to check his body. His arm, shoulder, and stomach were bandaged.
Did you do this? Reseng asked Mito.
Yes, at my friend's animal hospital. You lost a lot of blood. You almost died.
The cross-eyed librarian was looking at him with the same sour face as always. At least he assumed she was looking at him. He was never quite sure. What he was sure of was that she thought he was pathetic.
Next time, use a gun,
she said quietly, so Misa wouldn't hear.
Don't go rushing into battle if you're not up for it. You just end up making trouble for everyone else. The barber knows who I am now, thanks to you,
Mito said.
Sumin's been exposed too. All three of us are in danger because of what you did. It's also thrown a small wrench in the plot I came up with for bringing down Hanja. But that's okay. It just means I'll have to put things in motion now rather than later. It's important that we continue to think positive.
She glanced over at the librarian, who smiled back at her. Reseng could not figure out what was going through those crazy girls' heads.
You saved me from the barber. I don't suppose you managed to grab my knife too? Reseng asked, somewhat bashfully.
Mito gave him a frosty look. What did he want with Chu's knife? Reseng was surprised at himself for asking.
I'll take care of the barber, she said firmly. You have a different job to do.
Mito left the room, followed by the librarian. Reseng could hear the three of them laughing and chatting in the kitchen. Most of it was about how to cook rice porridge. After a moment, Misa appeared with a bowl. Mito and the librarian put on their coats and prepared to leave. While the librarian laced up her shoes at the front door, Mito came over to Reseng and whispered in his ear.
Don't get any stupid ideas in that empty head of yours. You'll only make things worse. Just eat your porridge and get lots of sleep until I summon you.
She dragged out the word lots. She and the librarian left. Misa dipped a spoon into the bowl, blew on it to cool it, then offered the spoon to Reseng. He gazed blankly for a moment at Misa's face and at the steam rising from the spoon. Misa held it closer. He opened his mouth. Her porridge, the first warm food he'd eaten in 5 days, was delicious. Reseng ate the whole bowl and fell back to sleep. Reseng slept just as Mito had told him to. He fell asleep and dreamed, and when he awoke, he ate more of Misa's porridge, then fell asleep again. No matter how much he slept, an endless drowsiness kept washing over him. He couldn't help wondering if Misa had added sleeping pills to the porridge. Or maybe there were sleeping pills in his water cup, or in the flowers in the vase, or in the warm sunlight spilling through the window and over his bed. He ate porridge and slept, and even in his dreams, he slept. In the evenings, Mito returned and undid Reseng's bandages to disinfect the wounds. Then she gave him an injection. On the nights Mito didn't come, the librarian changed his bandages for him instead.
"How did you get involved in all of this?"
Reseng asked the librarian as she wordlessly wrapped a clean bandage around him. She didn't answer.
"This isn't a game," he said. "You could die."
She pulled hard on the bandage as she tied it off. It was agony. Reseng felt as if the wound was going to burst. He groaned.
"You're not the only one with a story,"
she said, gathering up the scissors and the old bandages.
"So stop acting as if you know everything, as if you're the only tragic one here."
She was right. Everyone had a story. Old Raccoon, Chu, Bear, Mito, the barber, even Hanja. They fed their anger, hated one another, and even killed one another because of their particular story. They all believed their injuries justified their actions. But did they? What a load of crap, Reseng thought, then said to himself, "And you're as big of a prick as the rest of them." Now and then Reseng awoke to find Misa playing with her Winnie the Pooh on his stomach. It reminded him of how Desk and Lampshade used to fall asleep on his back or with their tails draped across his thigh.
"Aren't you a little old to play with stuffed animals?" Reseng asked. "Why not try something else?"
"Something else?"
she asked, stroking the loose seams on the doll.
"Yeah, for instance, you could get a cat. Cats make people happy."
Misa raised an eyebrow, considered the idea, but she shook her head.
"I don't want a cat or a dog. It will die before I do, and I can't get close to anything that will die before me. My stuffed animals will outlive me as long as I mend them."
She gave the old Winnie the Pooh a shake.
"How come you never ask any questions?"
"About what?"
"About anything."
"Because if I knew what was going on, I couldn't do anything about it. So I pretend not to know anything about the things I can't control. The more I pretend not to know, the more I actually don't know."
She smiled. Pooh shook his head on Reseng's stomach.
"Have you ever read a book called The Doubting Polar Bear by G.Y. Komdori?" he asked.
"Is that a famous writer?"
"Not at all. The book is about a polar bear who questions whether he's really a polar bear."
"Why would a polar bear question whether he's a polar bear?"
"Well, it's a funny story about a polar bear who wonders why he's a polar bear, specifically, and not any other kind of bear. Is it simply because he was born at the North Pole? He hates the fact that where he was born determines what he is, and he hates that he had no choice in the matter. He could have been a grizzly bear instead. Or a panda bear, for instance. He agonizes for a long time over why he had to be born a polar bear."
"Sounds more like a stupid bear to me."
"No. For a bear to be asking that sort of question, it means he's a very philosophical bear. Anyway, the doubting bear decides that he has to leave the North Pole in order to find out what kind of bear he really is. He opens up a map to look for a place that's completely different from the North Pole, and chooses California."
"A bear does that?"
"Yes, a bear does that."
She shook her head in disbelief.
"Wouldn't he need a boat or something to get all the way to California from there?"
"Sure, but sadly for him, the polar bear doesn't have a boat. So he saws off a piece of iceberg. He climbs onto it and sets sail for California. The wind blows hard, and the tides push him farther and farther away into the huge ocean. But the farther he gets from the North Pole, the faster his iceberg melts. His raft is disappearing beneath him, with no new land in sight, let alone California. when the enormous iceberg he started with is barely an ice cube, the doubting polar bear finally figures it out. Aha, he says. This is why I'm a polar bear, because I can never leave the North Pole. Then, the last of the ice melts and dumps him in the water, and the doubting polar bear has to swim all the way back home. The end.
Does the polar bear drown?
I don't know. The story ends with him still swimming.
I hope that bear was a good swimmer, Misa said worriedly.
Don't you think we're the same?
Same as what? That stupid polar bear?
We were all born at the North Pole, and we hate it at the North Pole, but no matter how hard we try, we can't leave.
Misa stared at him.
I don't mind the North Pole, she said, smiling brightly. California's too hot, and besides, who ever heard of a California bear? That just sounds weird. If I'm born at the North Pole, then I'll stick with being a polar bear.
With December, the frost arrived in the forest. By morning, the grass and leaves were pale, frozen, and covered with icy powder. The birdsong died, as if all the birds had left for warmer places. On the second day of December, Sumin, the librarian, chopped down a pine tree. That evening, the three women trimmed it with tiny lights, colorful balls, and ornaments shaped like presents, stars, bells, Santa Claus, and Rudolph, magic wands, and sweets. Misa turned bits of cotton into snowflakes and stuck them on the branches. Their laughter never stopped. They seemed intent on laughing until Christmas Day, but there was something anxious about their merriment. Their laughter had a nervous edge. It sounded at times like dogs howling at the dark. Their movements were exaggerated, their joy bordering on desperate, as if they were bracing for a coming sadness. Rezeng's wounds healed. He was able to walk around more easily, although he still had trouble standing up straight. Misa seemed entertained by the way he shuffled around with his bottom sticking out. She laughed her head off each time he went for a walk. Mito checked his scars and reminded him,
"You need to move around as much as possible."
So Rezeng went for walks in the forest around the cabin. The garden was wreathed with peach, pine, apricot, and chestnut trees. If no one had died and no one had been hurt, Rezeng thought, weekends at the cabin would have been peaceful and beautiful, as long as no one died or got hurt. The cabin had been built on a mountain slope. A single paved road led to the front, and out the back was a steep, narrow path inaccessible to cars. Rezeng examined the path. It was unpaved, with tree roots jutting out here and there. It didn't look as if a wheelchair could negotiate it. If assassins found them, the three women would never make it out alive. Already rumors would have spread about Resing's fighting the barber, about a woman disappearing with Rezeng. The rumors might have even reached Hanja's ears. Trackers could already be on the move. How long did they have? Mito and the librarian were coming and going constantly. Each night, after Misa went to bed, the two of them sat in the attic and had long, heated discussions. Some of the discussions dragged on so long that Rezeng could still hear their murmuring voices when the sun came up, but neither Mito nor the librarian told him anything. They didn't tell him how they planned to fight Hanja or Old Raccoon, or how the whole foolhardy lot of them intended to make a living later. Rezeng passed the time reading books and sleeping and gazing out the window at the wintry mountainscape. Sometimes he stared up at the roof beams and pictured the way the barber had moved. There one second, gone the next, light, easy, fluid, and lightning fast. If I fight him again, can I win? He wondered. No sooner did he ask himself that than an icy terror gripped him. He felt as if he were standing on the tip of a knife. It would be too difficult. If he went up against the barber again, he really would be a dead man. Rezeng awoke to find Mito standing over him. He had no idea how long she'd been there. Her expression was grim.
What time is it? He asked.
3 a.m.
What are you doing?
I have instructions for you.
I don't need your plans, just a gun and a knife.
Don't get any stupid ideas. Now is not the time for another of your childish tantrums.
When assassins come bursting in here, what are we going to fight them off with? Pots and pans?
The election is less than 20 days away. Hanja doesn't have time to worry about us, and frankly, he doesn't have any reason to yet. We're going to hit him before he hits us.
Fine. What the hell is your plan?
So you'll help?
Don't know. Can't make any guarantees. She gave him a long, quiet look before continuing.
I have all of Dr. Kung's data. Information on plots dating back 20 years of people who died without a trace. And Hanja keeps ledgers in his safe. They contain records of every transaction he's ever made with politicians, businessmen, the library, contract kill brokers, and assassins. He's landed himself a big account for the election, so that information will also be in the ledgers. Also, there's old Raccoon's book.
What book?
The book that describes in detail every major assassination in South Korea's modern history over the last 90 years. The previous library's directors wrote the chapters for the first 50 years, and Old Raccoon wrote the last 40.
Old Raccoon wrote a book? You certainly know a lot about it, considering you've never set foot in the library. Meanwhile, I've been there for 28 years and have never heard of it.
Mito glanced toward the librarian's bedroom.
There's definitely a book, and I know where it is.
Are you telling me that this book that will overturn everything we think we know about our contemporary Korean history and throw the entire country into turmoil is sitting right out in the open alongside the other 200,000 books in the library? Where? Next to Crime and Punishment? Or no, wait, I know. It's next to The Grace and Drama of Japanese Baseball, isn't it?
It's under Old Raccoon's study,
she said calmly. In the basement?
She nodded.
It's a thick book with a leather cover. Looks like a Bible. You'll know it when you see it.
How did you find it?
Men like Old Raccoon think all women are airheads, especially when those women are cross-eyed.
Rezeng burst out laughing. To think that the dopey-looking cross-eyed librarian had been screwing over Old Raccoon the whole time. Rezeng tried to imagine the look on proud Old Raccoon's face when he found out.
Hanja doesn't keep his ledgers at work, continued Mito. They're in a safe house, and only Hanja and his lawyer have access to them. Hanja won't respond to threats, but his lawyer will. He has two pretty daughters and a wife, and he's a weak, sniveling coward. If you poke him a few times with your knife, he'll start talking. As for the library basement, two people have access, Old Raccoon and you. If you can bring me both Old Raccoon's book and Hanja's ledgers, your work is done. Whatever you do after that is up to you. Once I have all three, including Dr. Kang's data, I'll be holding all the cards.
Rezeng stared at her. You really think you can pull it off? Even if you do get your hands on all those documents, you'll have every assassin in the country out for your blood. And not just them, the government, the military, the police, the prosecutors, everyone will be after you. Because everyone in this country who's ever held the slightest bit of power is connected to a plotter.
Aren't elections fun? It's like one big party. Ambition, greed, and vanity all gathered together in the same spot, all sticking their necks out, and everyone's eyes are fixed on the spectacle, hoping to see the lies exposed. It's perfect timing for something to explode, and everyone's hoping something will explode. I have a plan. What do you say? Will you help me?
Rezeng thought it over.
If you succeed, he said, then everyone I know dies. I'll die too. But the plotters behind the scenes, who control us like puppets, they'll come out of it alive. That's what history tells me.
Mito laughed.
Maybe, maybe not. I haven't gone into battle yet, but at least you won't die a cowardly polar bear.
The next day, the first snow of the year fell. Misa couldn't keep away from the window. She was completely entranced. But for Rezeng, the heavy blanket of snow made him feel cut off, as if he'd come too far and was in greater danger because of it. He added coal to the stove and topped up the kettle. The muscles in his side were still stiff, but he could move more easily now. Mitor and the librarian were gone. He felt relieved. If they'd been home, the three of them would have driven him crazy, prattling on all day, no doubt, about the snow.
"Isn't the world just so beautiful when it snows?"
Misa said as she gazed out the window. "Beautiful," Rezeng muttered. 2 centimeters of snow is all it takes to make the dirt and filth underneath beautiful. Misa frowned at him.
"Why are you so negative? It's just snow."
Rezeng laughed. "I guess you're right. It's just snow."
"Ah, I wish I could go out in it,"
she said, stretching her arms overhead. Rezeng immediately put on a hat and went out to sweep the snow. Snowdrifts filled the garden and forest path. He liked the feeling of cold flakes that stuck to his face and melted there. As a child, he used to spend hours sweeping up the cherry blossoms that swirled around the courtyard every spring. The broom had been taller than he was. He would sweep the ground clean and turn around, only to discover more fallen blossoms piled up behind him. Distraught by the dying flowers that never stopped falling, he had spent whole afternoons sweeping up blossoms. He finished clearing a path from the garden out to the main road and returned to the cabin. He got a blanket and tucked it around Misa's lap. "Put on a hat, or you're not going out," he said. Misa obediently pulled on a knit cap. He lifted her onto the wheelchair and took her outside. The wheels made a funny crunching sound as they rolled over the snow.
"Isn't my chair too heavy in the snow?"
she asked. "It's not heavy." Each time the wheels rattled over a rock or a root, Misa giggled. She stuck out her hand and caught a snowflake, then tilted her head back and let the flakes fall on her closed eyes. "What kind of life do you want to have?" Rezeng asked.
"I like this one,"
she said without opening her eyes.
"Just like this."
Mito returned in the middle of the night. The gears ground and the car engine sounded unnatural as it came toward the cabin over the snow-covered road. The headlights illuminated the front window. Then there was darkness. But Mito did not come in. Rezeng got out of bed and looked through the window. Mito had both hands on the steering wheel with her head down, and her shoulders were shaking. She sat in the car for half an hour before finally coming in. Rezeng got back into bed and pretended to be asleep. He heard the refrigerator door open and close, followed by the sound of Mito slumping on the floor. Then, for a long time, he heard nothing at all. Rezeng stared up at the ceiling in the dark for another 20 minutes before getting out of bed and going to the kitchen. He turned on the light and found Mito curled up next to the fridge, crying. He looked at her for a moment and got a bottle of water from the fridge. He drank a glass himself, then poured a glass for Mito. "I didn't know tough bitches like you ever cried," he said. Her smile was more of a sneer. She took a sip. Rezeng sat at the table. Mito wiped her tears away with her sleeve.
"Aren't you going to ask why a tough bitch like me is crying?"
she asked playfully, her eyes still welling with tears.
"No, women cry for as many reasons as there are stars in the sky."
She nodded in agreement.
"If I let you live, could you look after Misa?"
The look in her eyes was mournful and earnest.
"For 3 years.
Rezeng looked at her quizzically. She added,
"I'm not saying that's what will happen, but just in case."
"What about you?" he asked.
"I'm not going to live that long."
"Why should you die while I get to live? Because of that stupid morality of yours about monsters or whatever. Your dying won't change the world, so just live. What's the point of single-handedly saving the world and then being the only one who dies? What kind of bullshit is that? Who do you think you are, Jesus?"
"I killed a little girl today. I gave her an injection. A little girl who's been in a coma since she was 9. A little girl with no sins and no power. And I killed her with an injection.
Mito sounded drunk. Who was she?
The barber's daughter.
Reseng stood up. He'd seen a pack of cigarettes somewhere in that kitchen. As he was opening the empty coffee jar on the shelf and peeking inside, Mito pulled a pack from her pocket and offered him one. He took it and lit it. On his second inhale, a wave of dizziness hit him. It was his first cigarette in a month.
Why her? He asked.
Because she was what kept him working, not Hunter.
His left eye was suddenly throbbing. He rubbed it with his palm. Had he ever killed before, out of faith or justice or anything like that? Never. He hadn't believed in those things. He'd killed because he was told to kill, because the person he killed was on a list, and because he was an assassin. What was Mito killing for? The idea that you could kill someone for something that you believed in suddenly filled him with fear. When he thought about it, that might have been what made plotters tick. Reseng took another drag.
People hide their true motivations even from themselves, he said. And they have to invent fake motivations in order to keep on fooling themselves. You don't know what your true motivation is, do you? You don't actually know what you're doing, do you? From what I see, you're no different from the rest of us. You're just like the barber, and just like Hunja. You're exactly like all the other plotters out there. This new world you're imagining will end up being no different from the old world. The way cats still catch mice, no matter what color they are. He stubbed his cigarette out in the water pooled at the bottom of the sink and tossed it in the garbage bin. Mito was still slumped on the floor, a look of devastation on her face. I'll get Hunja's ledgers for you, he said, aiming the words at the top of her head. But not old Raccoon's book. That's the best I can do. The next afternoon, Reseng packed his things. Misa brought out winter clothes from the wardrobe and put them in his bag. The clothes had belonged to the sister's deceased father. Most were slightly too big for Reseng.
Your father was tall?
Tall and handsome,
she said, with a smile.
I'll drop you off at the station,
Mito said, standing next to him. He could tell she wanted to say something to him in private.
No thanks, he said. I want to walk alone.
With one eye on Misa, she offered him an envelope. He looked at it. He assumed it contained the location of Hunja's safe house and the room with the safe, the method for bypassing the security system, the date and time the lawyer would be there, and the list of ledgers he needed to retrieve. He put the envelope in his bag.
Don't be late, she said.
I won't, he said firmly.
Reseng smiled at Misa. She looked sad. He patted her on the shoulder and turned to leave, then walked slowly down the now slushy road. Misa waved until he was out of sight. Hunja's safe house was in a quiet residential area. It was an ordinary two-story home with a well-tended garden. The neighboring house was so close, the eaves were nearly touching. It was the kind of home where Reseng half expected to see a family man walking up to the front door with a giant birthday cake for his twin daughters. Following Mito's instructions, Reseng climbed onto the neighbor's roof first and jumped over to the roof of Hunja's safe house. Next to a water tank was a boiler cabinet with a 30-centimeter square ventilation window. He gave the window frame a shake. It was shoddy quality. He was certain he could lift the frame out without breaking the glass. This is her big idea for getting me inside. Some plotter she is, he thought with a laugh. Hunja's lawyer still hadn't arrived. Reseng checked his watch. 8 p.m. With his back against the water tank, he took the PB6P9 out of the holster and looked at it in the glow of the streetlight. He unscrewed the silencer and reattached it, then took out the magazine, pulled back the empty slide, and released the trigger. Not bad, he thought. He liked Russian handguns, because they were quiet. So quiet that the gun seemed to have been designed for the silencer rather than the other way around. When was the last time he'd used a handgun?
Several years ago, at least. If they had to get close enough to a target to need a handgun, then most professionals preferred knives. Handguns were sloppy and left behind gunpowder residue and bullet casings. Not that he had to concern himself with that anymore. He started to take out a cigarette from the pack in his pocket, but hesitated. Then he took one out anyway and lit it. One more thing to stop worrying about. When he was halfway through the cigarette, his cell phone vibrated. Mito was calling.
Hunter's lawyer just left the office. He'll be there in 20, she said.
Don't do anything stupid like try to tail him. Just get over here and wait.
When you get the ledgers, tell him you'll give them back for 750 million won. Otherwise, Hanja will get suspicious.
Why's it got to be 750? Rezin grumbled. Why not an even 700 or 800?
The lawyer will have two bodyguards with him. Be careful. I'll be in the alley across the street.
She hung up. Rezin stubbed out his cigarette and slipped the butt into his pocket out of habit. Then he removed the ventilation window, slowly lowered it to the floor, and stuck his head inside. The space was tight, but if he wiggled his shoulders, he wouldn't have too much trouble getting in and out. Just as Mito had said, the lawyer arrived almost 20 minutes later. Rezin stuck his head out over the roof and watched. A heavy-set man came running out to open the car door. The lawyer got out of the back seat, followed by a tall, slender man who appeared to be a bodyguard. He looked strong and deadly. The engine shut off, and a man who looked nothing like a chauffeur got out from behind the wheel. One fat guy, two bodyguards, and a lawyer. If things went sideways, this could get complicated. As the lawyer went into the house, Rezin slipped through the ventilation window. He cracked open the door to the boiler cabinet and waited. He heard the men talking on the first floor. After a moment, the lawyer came up to the second floor alone, unlocked one of the rooms, and went inside. That room would have the safe. Rezin quietly crept out into the hallway and checked the first floor. The other three men were eating in the kitchen and cracking jokes. Rezin came back and tested the knob to the door of the lawyer's room. It was locked from the inside. He glanced downstairs again. The three men were laughing loudly. Rezin knocked on the door. He heard the lawyer say,
"What is it?"
He waited and didn't answer. More laughter from the kitchen. He knocked again. He heard a chair squeak and the lawyer's irritable-sounding voice. Rezin squeezed a wet handkerchief in his left hand and gripped the gun with his right.
"What the hell is it?"
the lawyer asked as he opened the door. Instantly, Rezin shoved the wet handkerchief into the lawyer's mouth as he pushed him backward into the room, then fired a bullet into his left thigh. The lawyer looked bewildered as he gazed down at his bleeding leg. Rezin turned to check downstairs. The sound of raucous laughter was still coming from the kitchen. He closed the door and locked it. "Make a sound and I shoot you in the head. Got it?" The lawyer nodded. Rezin took the handkerchief out of the lawyer's mouth. Then he shot him in the left knee. The lawyer shrieked. Rezin raised one eyebrow. "Were you deaf? I just said 2 seconds ago that I would shoot you in the head if you made a sound." He aimed the gun. The lawyer closed his mouth, his eyes welling with tears. "Think you can follow directions now?" The lawyer nodded repeatedly. Rezin shot him again in the left knee. The lawyer gritted his teeth and fell to the floor. He rolled from side to side, smearing the carpet with blood. After a moment, he seemed to adjust to the pain, and his groans subsided. Rezin nodded at him. "That's a very painful place to get shot, but you're handling it like a champ. I guess that's how you were able to pass the bar exam." Rezin sat down at the table in the middle of the room. The lawyer had his face to the floor, grinding his teeth. Rezin lit a cigarette. "You won't be able to use that knee anymore. The knee joint's a tricky thing. Once it's broken, it's very difficult to repair. But there's a big difference between limping on one leg and limping on two legs. You could say it's the difference between a cane and a wheelchair." Rezin exhaled a long puff of smoke. "So, what do you think? Would you like to keep your right knee?" The lawyer nodded. "I need Hanja's ledgers. I know they're here, and I know you know how to open the safe, so open it. If you drag your feet, you'll spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. If you don't open it, you're dead.
The lawyer looked up at him.
What do you need the ledgers for?
I'm planning to retire, but no one's offering me a pension.
There's money in that suitcase, around 300 million. You can have it.
Under the desk was a black wheeled suitcase. Rezing walked over, the cigarette in his mouth, and opened it. It was filled with cash.
300 million?
The lawyer nodded.
300? That's an awful lot of cash. I guess it's because it's election time. Anyway, thanks.
Rezing picked up the suitcase and walked back to the lawyer. He stared down at him. The lawyer raised his head and stared back. Rezing raised his gun and shot the lawyer in the right thigh. The lawyer stifled a shriek.
The next bullet's going in your knee, so out with it. Where are Hanja's ledgers?
The lawyer's face twisted in pain.
If I give them to you, I'm dead anyway.
I hate lawyers. You guys are always so sharply dressed, so calculating, so smooth with your logic, and so slippery, you think you can worm your way out of anything. But how are you going to get out of this one? I think today is the day you're going to have to apply the same impeccable logic as when you waltzed into the library with Chong'an's body. Do you prefer to die at my hands after I've run out of bullets shooting you in every single one of your joints, or at Hanja's hands? Think fast, now. I don't have a lot of time.
Rezeng aimed the gun again.
The safe is under the desk.
Rezeng grabbed him by the back of the collar and dragged him over. The lawyer balked. Rezeng pressed the gun to his head. The lawyer pulled back the carpet underneath the desk, took a remote control out of his pocket, and keyed in a number. The floor opened, revealing a safe. The lawyer keyed in another number, and the safe opened. Inside were several ledgers and CDs. Rezeng stuffed them all into his backpack. The lawyer stared at him dumbly.
This is what you tell Hanja. All I need is money. 2 billion in bearer bonds, 1 billion in cash. Split the cash evenly into 2 leather bags.
The lawyer nodded. He looked relieved. Just then, there was an urgent knocking at the door. Rezeng turned to the lawyer, who looked panicked.
What do you push? Rezeng asked.
I forgot to cancel the alarm when I opened the safe.
A lame excuse. Rezeng zipped the backpack shut and looked at the lawyer, who was now shaking uncontrollably. Rezeng frowned and shot him in the right knee. This time, the lawyer screamed at the top of his voice. The knocking changed to pounding, and then someone started kicking the door. Rezeng pressed himself to the wall next to it. He slowed his breathing and cracked the door open just as the man outside was in mid-kick. The man fell into the room. It was the driver. Rezeng shot him in both legs. Then he shot at the slender man standing in the hallway. The slender man did a front somersault, dodging the muzzle of the gun, and grabbed Rezeng by the arm into a shoulder throw. It was a smooth, skillful move. Rezeng dropped his gun as he was hurled to the hallway floor, and the slender man grabbed it. Rezeng stood, massaging his shoulder. The man pointed the gun at him. He looked at ease with the weapon. From his shoulder holster, Rezeng took a brand new Henkels that he'd bought at a department store on the way there. The man sneered.
What are you, stupid? I've got a gun,
the slender man said.
You're out of bullets. Your boss wasn't very cooperative.
The man pointed the gun at the wall and pulled the trigger. It clicked. He tossed the gun to the floor. There was another in his jacket, but it looked like a tear gas gun. He pulled a knife from his belt, a military knife used in the special forces.
Have we met? Rezeng asked.
Yeah, at Chu's funeral.
Indeed, it was the same beanpole of a man who had accompanied Hanja the day they cremated Chu.
You don't look like an assassin. I'm guessing you're a soldier, Rezeng said.
I was for a long time.
Then keep being one. Defend your country and your family, with honor.
Honor doesn't put food on the table, the slender man said, raising his knife.
Rezeng lowered his knife and walked closer. His stride was easy, as if he were out on a stroll. The man lunged at Rezeng's face. Rezeng pivoted left to dodge the blade and slashed the other man from shoulder to armpit. The man dropped his knife. Rezeng moved to the right and slipped his knife gently into the man's side. The man fell to his knees. He lowered his head, but didn't groan. Rezeng pulled the knife out. Then he picked up the fallen gun, put it back in the holster, took out a handkerchief, and wiped the blood from his knife. When he went back into the room, the lawyer was flailing in a pool of blood and talking to someone on his cell phone.
"It's that asshole from the library. He's taking the ledgers. Yes, yes, they're right next to me. I've been shot. No, not bought, shot."
Rezeng looked down at the lawyer in amusement. The lawyer glanced up at him and put the phone down, terrified.
"You work too hard," Rezeng said.
He took his backpack off the desk, picked up the suitcase full of cash, and headed downstairs. Halfway down, the fat man appeared with a baseball bat. Despite his size, the man's hands were trembling violently. Rezeng looked more closely. It was the same security guard from Hanja's office, the pack of hot dogs. Rezeng sneered as he glanced up at the bat.
"You counting on hitting me with that?"
The pack of hot dogs looked up at the bat too, fear spelled out clearly on his face. Rezeng shook his head.
"Come on, don't use that on people," he said.
The pack of hot dogs collapsed on the floor. Rezeng opened the front door and walked outside. When he reached the alleyway, he saw Mito's car. He tapped on the window. She rolled it down. He took his backpack off and handed it to her.
"This should settle my debt," he said.
Mito unzipped the bag, pulled out one of the ledgers, and checked the contents. Rezeng held up the suitcase he'd taken from the lawyer.
"I'll give you this if you promise to stop now and leave the country with Mita. There's 300 million in here."
"You think you can buy me?"
"Maybe."
"Get in."
He shook his head,